This message is from the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.
In the news not too long ago was the tragic story of a ferry that capsized off the coast in Seoul, South Korea. Hundreds of passengers died, most of them high school students who were on a trip, who ended up drowning because they were simply awaiting instructions on what to do. The instructions were late in coming because, as it turned out, the captain had fled the sinking ship early on and was later found on dry land. I came across one report with contrasting response to a dangerous scenario. A fire had broken out during an Air Canada flight from Dallas to Toronto. The pilot began a sudden and a dramatic descent, knowing that there wasn't a lot of time if any of them were to survive. As soon as he landed the plane and the door was open for rescue, the whole aircraft sort of sucked in that oxygen and quickly began to turn into an inferno. Because of his skill and commitment, along with crew members, nearly all of the passengers were able to escape safely. But what the news reports eventually focused on was the fact that this captain had been the last person to leave the burning airplane. In fact, when he was eventually pulled out by rescuers through a window they broke open, his own uniform was on fire. He certainly deserved the commendation he received as someone who put his life on the line. If you were to travel back to the middle part of the first century, you would observe the church in the throes of experiencing difficulty and growing danger. The fires of unrest and uncertainty would, in fact, in a matter of a few years, break into an inferno of persecution against them. Much of the apostolic energy of Paul and Peter, James and others is devoted to developing and organizing and teaching the church on how to survive difficult times. And one of the leading questions was, who is going to be willing to serve as captain of the boat, crew of the ship, especially when it begins to take on water? Who is going to pilot the airplane now that smoke can be seen and the flames of growing persecution and danger are all the more dangerous? Both Paul and Peter specifically urged men who wore the mantle of shepherd to captain the vessel, to pilot the plane, or in New Testament terminology, to shepherd the flock, to put everything on the line, including their own safety for the sake of the church. Now, in our last session together in Peter's first letter, and I invite you to turn back there, we uncovered the job description of these men, focusing primarily on the elder bishop pastor, that office of leadership in the church we discovered together, which was known in the New Testament by three terms. Those terms appear, in fact, in this text, not obviously, they're in the original language. The term elder, presbyteros, refers or relates to his leading the flock. The term pastor or poimen refers to feeding the flock, literally pasturing, a wooden translation, the flock. And the term bishop or episkopos, which related to ruling the flock. Now, in this letter that we've been studying together, Peter has been encouraging the church at large to stand strong in faith and hope during difficult times. But now, as this chapter opens, this paragraph opens, Peter kind of pulls over on the side of the road, as it were, and with a few choice, emotional, highly charged comments, speaks personally to the elders of the early church. He writes again in verse 1, "Therefore, I exhort the elders among you as fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed, shepherd the flock of God among you, tend the sheep, feed the flock, care for the church." And what you might expect Peter to do next is kind of give the nitty-gritty of, you know, the daily exercise of what it means to do that. You know, whether it's, you know, rest on Monday, visit on Tuesday, disciple on Wednesday, you know, study on Thursday, pray on Friday, write your sermon on Saturday. But instead of focusing on the calendar, what Peter does is focus on the character. Instead of focusing on the pastor's schedule, he focuses on the pastor's spirit. And he essentially lays out for the elder team of every local church to this day what I want to call, for the sake of an outline, three principles of shepherding the flock. And let me give you the first principle and then we'll read the text. Here it is. First, ministry does not depend on coerciveness but willingness. Notice further in verse 2, exercising oversight not under compulsion but voluntarily according to the will of God. Not under compulsion literally means not to be compelled by force or some kind of constraint. The pastor, elder, bishop is not drafted. They volunteer. And they volunteer with a sense of divine calling, as Peter writes it here, according to the will of God. No one is forced into this kind of ministry role. In other words, this ministry role is something that God, according to His will, has planted in your heart. You don't make someone, you don't talk someone into becoming a shepherd. Even here at Shepherd's Theological Seminary, hosted by our church on this campus, faculty members fully understand that the Shepherd's Seminary, or any seminary, doesn't make shepherds. We don't call shepherds into ministry. Their training and their education and their master's degrees don't make them shepherds either. We can't make someone a pastor, elder, bishop. God does that. Wanting to become a shepherd is implanted in their hearts by the will of God. And it is a great danger to the church should any man assume the office who isn't doing it according to the will of God, but by their own will. Or their parents' will. Or I come from a long line. You ought to hear about my great-grandfather. Wanting to become this is implanted in their hearts by God. So what this means is that no one can make men into ministers. We merely train men for that for which God has made them. And how can you tell if God is making someone by doing that in their heart? Well, for one thing, Peter implies a volume of truth here as he reveals the man's heart and spirit. You discover in that man that even though shepherding is going to involve a lifetime of study, long hours, bearing other people's burdens, the heartache and tears, as well as joys and victories of ministry, you find these men actually willingly volunteering. They aren't forced into it. They are outfitted for it by God. By the way, just because elders volunteer, some unpaid, some full-time paid. That doesn't mean it's easy for them to fulfill it. In fact, for all of you who serve, and we're going to have hundreds and hundreds of people who are going to serve Christ by serving the church today, those of you who serve in some way in the church, you know it as well. You're not volunteering for that role because it's easy or because it's comfortable, you know, or it just really jazzes you up, you know, whenever you finish, you know, teaching that class of third graders. People might be led to believe that for the pastor, elder, bishop, well, that just comes easy. I'm reading for my own soul from Charles Spurgeon's classic work entitled Lectures to My Students. Just a few pages a day, sometimes just a few pages a week. It just sits there on my stand. You may be aware that Spurgeon had a college hosted in his church, the Metropolitan Tabernacle, for pastoral training in London during the 1800s. A college then is tantamount to seminary now, just the terminology's changed. He taught his students every Friday afternoon. And those lectures were eventually compiled in a book on pastoring entitled Lectures to My Students. One particular chapter he humorously entitled The Minister's Fainting Fits, in which he rather transparently and candidly wrote and encouraged these men with the truth. He said this: fits of depression come over most of us, usually cheerful as we may be. We must at intervals be cast down. The strong are not always vigorous. The wise are not always prepared. And the joyous are not always happy. There may be among us men of iron, but surely the rust frets even us. Willingness does not mean easiness. And Peter is sending out a description. In fact, think about it this way. He's giving the job description of the pastor, bishop, elder to the congregation. Can you imagine your job being known by every other employee at the company where you work? He's giving this to the body, and I think in that is healthy accountability. And he's telling us right away that a faithful elder is going to remain at his post, not because he's forced to enter it, not because he's compelled, not because it's easy, but because he is simply willing to follow the will of God. So it does not depend on coerciveness, but willingness. Secondly, motives are not driven by greediness, but eagerness. Motives are not driven by greediness, but eagerness. Notice again verse 2. Shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but voluntarily according to the will of God. Now notice, and not for sordid gain, but with eagerness. Now the term Peter uses for eagerness is a strong term that means enthusiasm. It means devoted zeal. In this context, elders serve the flock with enthusiasm and devoted zeal. And it is tragic. Wouldn't it be for a flock to follow leaders who really don't want to do it, who have no zeal, no enthusiasm, who just show up, clock in, and go home? They get out of bed every morning ready for another day at it. Not like perhaps a teenager who stays up too late and can't get out of bed. In fact, in his commentary on this text, Chuck Swindoll told a story about a young man like that. He was sound asleep on Sunday morning when his mother burst into his room and said, "Get out of bed now." And he had his face buried in his pillow and he kind of muffled, "Give me three good reasons why I should get up." She said, "Well, for one, because it's Sunday and you know that we always go to church on Sunday." The guy just moaned. "And two, because we have only 40 minutes until church starts and you haven't even showered. And three, because you're the pastor of the church." "Now get up." Peter is describing a man who gets out of bed, ready to go. He contrasts eagerness, notice here, with greediness. In other words, what is it that does fire up your engine? Is it to feed the flock or to fleece the flock? Like the Apostle Paul wrote to Timothy, young pastor, warning him that an elder must not be a lover of money, 1 Timothy 3:3. He wrote to Titus and described an elder as someone who was not greedy for gain, Titus 1:7. In fact, he delivered his own personal testimony, Paul did, in Acts chapter 20, verse 33, that he never in his ministry coveted anybody's silver or gold. The question, hey, what's in it for me, is the question of a hireling who does what he does in guarding the flock only because he's paid. But when the wolves appear, he's going to run. When the boat begins to tip over, he's going to get out of there. Never mind anybody else. You know, when the plane gets on fire, well, hey, that exit door is closest to me, the pilot. I'm the first one out. He doesn't ask that kind of question. The term Peter uses for sordid gain is actually elastic. It is a word that can refer to more than money. It's a word that can refer to a greed, a greediness for a following. A greediness for approval. A hunger for attention. Or comfort. And Pastor Henry Jowett, who lived during Spurgeon's day, wrote 100 years ago, there's a wonderful little commentary on 1 Peter. He said this, I am not sure which of the two is worse in a pastor. He who hungers for money or he who thirsts for applause. Both are dangerous. Peter is describing here a man to whom the flock matters. It isn't a job. It isn't a paycheck. It isn't perks of power. It isn't approval. It isn't applause. It isn't attention. None of that is guaranteed anyway. Whether or not the perks and the applause and the benefits ever come into play, he's in this for life. He gets out of bed in the morning with this internal desire to obey Christ and fulfilling the will of God who outfitted him, fashioned him for this ministry. Now that doesn't mean the elder pastor bishop is never discouraged, as Spurgeon wrote, or never have days when life isn't so energetic or the ministry less than enthusiastic. This phrase Peter uses is sort of a big picture description. This is sort of an over the long haul kind of word for the tone, the spirit, the attitude of the elder. His ministry does not depend on coerciveness but willingness. His motives are not driven by greediness but eagerness. Third, his mannerisms are not displayed through haughtiness, but selflessness. Notice Peter writes in verse 3, nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge. Stop for a moment. This is interesting. Elders are indeed given a divine allotment of sheep. It isn't up to the shepherd to say, I want 100 more. Or I'd like 50 less. That's the work of Christ who builds the church, each individual church. And Peter informs them here of this good reminder, whoever it is you're leading, they were allotted to you by God. It's a healthy perspective. Those, you could translate it, those entrusted to you. So the elder is entrusted with the charge. The elder is given the care of a particular flock, and he is to be devoted to that flock. And it is discouraging and despairing for a flock to have elders or an elder, pastor, bishop, that they know really doesn't care about them. I'm not going to mention his name. He's deceased. But I have his books on my shelf. You would highly revere and respect him as a theologian and author. And everything he writes, I underline. But this was in the later years of his ministry where he ended up. In fact, the last church he took, and he took several, the last church he took only if the elders that brought him on agreed that he would not have to do anything related to people. He said, I want to study, and I want to write, and I want to preach my sermons, and that's it. And they actually agreed. And he would preach a sermon, and he would go down the hall during the benediction, and he'd hide in the nursery room until the church had left. You also observe in this text that leading the flock is not the same thing as lording over the flock. In fact, the word translated lording over is a compound term made up of combining the verb to control with the preposition translated down, to control down, to rule down. This relates to a heavy-handed leadership. The church is not a herd of cattle to be driven and whipped. It is a flock of sheep to be led. And Peter, no doubt, draws here from the Judean hillsides where he has often seen shepherds customarily walking in front of the flock, calling the sheep after him. Yes, the flock needs to be challenged and nudged and disciplined and warned and rebuked and taught. It's also true the flock is never allowed to go wherever the flock wants to go. In fact, I've seen that tragedy play out where the church is trying to rule and govern itself without leadership. But the elder, pastor, bishop is out in front. Why? Peter tells us you're out in front, not so that you can provide an example of haughtiness, not so you can say, hey, I'm out front. You know, look at me. But humility. So undergirding this is obviously the love of Christ for the flock. It isn't even loving preaching. It isn't even loving teaching. I see a lot of that. Well, why do you do what you do? I love to preach. Well, I do too. But that isn't it. Loving to preach is vastly different than loving those to whom you preach. In fact, I can remember years ago back in the middle school when the church was young, and I was too. And I had a man leave a church and come to ours. He was a gifted teacher. And he began to teach one of our Sunday school classes. Very gifted. But even though I was much younger than him, about 20 years younger, it became apparent to me that he may have left the other church because he didn't get the platform he wanted and he'd come here to this one. That he loved to teach more than he loved the flock that he taught. And I remember him coming into my office. We rented. And I had sort of drummed up the courage. I was barely 30. He was in his early 50s. And he said, look, I got my calendar and I'm ready to teach next fall. You know, tell me what you want me to do. And I kind of pushed back from my desk and I said, hey, let me ask you this. Do you simply love to teach, or do you love this flock that you're teaching? And he said immediately, oh, hey, I just love to teach. Let me tell you, I'm going to teach anywhere. I said, well, I can appreciate that, but I'm really praying that God will give us men who want to teach this flock, who will give their lives to this flock. And he kind of went, well, I don't know about that. And I said, well, you're not going to teach. And he left the church. This is a trust to whom the elder, pastor, bishop has been given from God to care for and to lead, and haughtiness has no place in it. A desire to be up front has no place in it. In fact, it is damaging to the flock. In fact, notice how Peter underscores that at the heart of shepherding is a ministry of modeling. Notice this, he writes, proving to be examples to the flock. Paul wrote to Pastor Timothy again and told him to set an example, same word, for the believers in speech, in life, in love, in faith, in purity. Do you really want to be that? Do you really want to be out front? Well, if you're out front, then you accept all the burdens related to being an example in life, in faith, in purity. And of course, being an example would follow the Lord, the Good Shepherd, who laid aside all his power. Imagine that power. Who laid aside his glory. Imagine his glory. And came humbling himself, and he became, Philippians 2, a servant. See, Peter knows the danger of being full of himself. Just watch me. Lord, you haven't seen anything yet. Just step back and watch. He knows the pitfalls when someone is given position and power and a pedestal of public ministry that no one deserves. But they begin to face incredible temptations related to pride. John Henry Jowett again wrote from years of pastoral experience 100 years ago, proving, by the way, that something's never changed. I love this quote. Pride lurks at the heels of power. Even a little authority is prone to turn someone's walk into a strut. Well said. There's no place in ministry, there's no place in the flock for any of us to strut. Even in preaching or teaching, a true shepherd doesn't just love to preach. He loves the people to whom he preaches. And with that future in mind, where we will one day stand before the chief shepherd, notice two incentives for shepherding the flock. First, the chief shepherd's return. Verse 4, and when the chief shepherd appears, here's an incentive for every pastor, elder, bishop. The chief shepherd is going to appear. By the way, I find it interesting that although the elder isn't to be motivated by duty or greed or perks or power, there is a proper incentive. In fact, the apostles' teaching throughout the New Testament for both shepherds and sheep is this future coming of Christ should shape the way we live now. And this isn't done as a scare tactic. You know, he's coming. It certainly can include that, but Peter isn't trying to scare elders, you know, into keeping their noses clean. You know, like maybe your parents did when you were growing up. They said, you know, finish your homework before we get home. We're leaving. We're not telling you when we're getting back, but your homework better be done when we get back. And you just do your homework. It's not Peter's idea here. He's using this incentive for shepherds who no doubt face their own failures, their own shortcomings. They know the failures and shortcomings of the flock, but here's the remedy. Be encouraged with anticipation to stay at that ship, that wheel, that plane, that flock. Because at any moment the Lord can appear, and he calls him here the chief shepherd, the only time this appears in the New Testament. Why? I think he's implying because the chief shepherd, the perfect shepherd, is going to come and finish what none of you could ever finish. None of you under shepherds could ever complete. None of you could ever fulfill. He will come and he will complete the church. He will perfect the church. He will glorify the flock as he calls her home. He's coming. You just guide her and guard her, because ultimately you're going to hand her off to the chief shepherd. When he comes, Peter highlights not only the chief shepherd's return, he mentions secondly the chief shepherd's reward. You will receive the unfading crown of glory. Keep in mind that every believer here is going to receive a crown. Every one of us. We don't know if some of them are going to have some kind of distinguishing mark, those for martyrs or elders, soul winners, whatever. We're not sure. I kind of like to think of it as we're all graduating. We're all in the line. We've all got our black robes on. You know, to the surprise of many, there we are. But yet some have some kind of designation, a pin, something they've won, some award they've received, gold braiding perhaps, for those who studied. I had no gold braiding. I had no pins. I had a black robe, and I was in line. Hallelujah. We're all going to be saying hallelujah. Maybe some kind of special designation. We don't know. Paul calls it an incorruptible crown. A crown of glory. A crown of righteousness. A crown of life, James calls it. Every believer is royalty yet to be crowned. But here the elder is reminded that he too will be rewarded for his service to the chief shepherd with a crown. And Peter adds here what no other New Testament text adds, just in this way. He says, you're going to receive an unfading Stephanos, an unfading crown. This is that laurel wreath given to victorious military personnel. This is the wreath given at the games to the victorious athletes. It was made, depending on the season, of woven myrtle leaves or olive leaves or oak leaves, sometimes interspersed with violets or roses. And Peter kind of hints at this by pointing out, by contrast, what do all those wreaths have in common? They all fade away. They all crumble. They're all, you know, tattered. They sit on your fireplace mantle and they're just, you know, dust. And you can hardly, you know, remember the moment. Not this Stephanos, this unfading crown of glory. It's never going to fade away. We're going to enjoy the glory of what the crown represents. It is glory we do not deserve. It is glory we did not earn. And maybe, and this is my imagination here, but perhaps the elders of the church will once again take the lead and provide the example by being the first to take our crowns and place them at the feet of Jesus. Because every true elder knows he was enabled by Christ. He was gifted by Christ. He was called by Christ, encouraged by Christ, entrusted sheep to him by Christ. He deserves then nothing. He gives everything to the chief shepherd. Peter says, don't forget that coming day when imperfect shepherds who led imperfect sheep give an accounting and are rewarded by the perfect shepherd who welcomes the sheep home. That'll be a great way to end ministry. That'll be a great way to begin eternity. Father, we're grateful for this text. It is an open job description for the pastor, elder, bishop. It is within this job description filled with nuances and implications for the flock as well. I can't help, Father, but think how grateful I am that we dealt with a text like this on a day like this when we have had 76 men, elders and deacons, acknowledged. new deacons and elders commissioned. You have so blessed this flock with men like these. For all who serve this local body, we thank you for the encouragement in knowing that you have gifted all of us and outfitted all of us for that role we play. We all look toward the day of your appearing. And there are so many things that you could get on to us about. And yet, the scriptures over and over highlight you're coming to reward that which you've seen in us. And I think that's going to surprise us, Father. I think we're all going to be amazed all over again, as we've saw, by your grace. Thank you most of all that you love us, and we love you.
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. This message is copyrighted and may be shared, but not sold or altered. For information or to access more resources, visit wisdomonline.org.